Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. And tonight is our full moon vigil, first month gone by in our summer retreat. And some of us have been on silent retreat or not engaging in the community. In work or pujas, and have just had time at our dwelling places. Others will be having the opportunity. We've been doing it, do it in groups through this summertime. So it's a good opportunity to bring a focus back to formal aspects of practice and really investigate the kind of the basis of why we practice, how we practice. I mean, we should be doing this all the time anyway, but it's good to have periods of time where we really turn our attention to it more exclusively. At one point, His Holiness the Dalai Lama was asked by somebody, "What's the point of your practice?" And he just answered, "I'm preparing to die," which is sort of wonderfully succinct. Didn't have to go through a whole explanation of Vajrayana, Mahayana, Theravada, whole Buddhist history, all the philosophical schools. But cut to the chase of what spiritual practice is for and what a human life is for, really. I mean, we're basically, we are in this condition of having taken birth and find ourselves what for? What to do with it? So that that recognition of birth and death, and particularly in terms of say Buddhist practice or Buddhist teachings, the Buddha recognizes the necessity of having right view, that's the first step on the path. And there's two aspects to right view. And the kind of the worldly or mundane aspect of right view is looking at things in terms of cause and effect, conditions, that there's whatever causes we put in, there'll be results, and that there is the results of good actions and bad actions. There is the wholesome and the unwholesome, and there's this life, there's another life. That this is not it's not a one-shot deal, where we're kind of born there's no rhyme or reason for it, and then you die and you're annihilated. That's not a Buddhist perspective. It's sort of fundamental to the aspect of worldly or mundane right view. Also, that there are part of right view is that there are beings who have been able to purify themselves. There are beings who we have particular affinities towards, parents, teachers, and that there are also beings who have been able to purify themselves, been able to free themselves. It's not a impossibility. So that this aspect of right view is—it's actually important to take on board and consider. When it's not a belief system, and it's not one isn't required to accept it without questioning, but to take it as a perspective. And then recognize the implications of it and see if it has any relevance. But certainly this, in terms of recognizing that, say, with coming back to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, that when he's asked, what's the point of your practice? So I'm preparing to die, and that's somebody who is extraordinarily revered, and for his purity and his candor and his humor and his humanness and his wisdom. And by the system that he lives in, he is the 14th Dalai Lama, so they are these incarnate beings who come back in the same way that basically everybody comes back, but his particular goal is to come back and bring benefit and to cultivate more good, sow the seeds of that goodness for other people. So that when we reflect on it for ourselves, we similarly taking that perspective, if that's the case, how are we using our practice? Just at tea time, at the end of tea time, I was asked a question in Thai, so hardly anybody else knew what the answer was. So when I'm explaining, but one of the Thai women who are here meditating and and having that insight into the just the quickness of the mind, and that the even when you're meditating and trying to bring the mind to peace, to tranquility, to clarity, and you have that wholesome intention, have that desire and wish to allow them, bring the mind to a place of peace. You know, there's sound of a dog barking, and the mind goes out to that, and then there's a some other sound or distraction, the mind goes out to that, and the mind doesn't stay still. It's just so quick. Even when there's that intention or that training. And the question was, is with this, if that, say by the Buddha's teachings, then that constitutes sort of becoming and birth. By the when analyzing the say the movement of the mind, when the mind moves, there is a becoming, and when it becomes something, fastens onto something, an idea, a concept, a place, then that it takes birth there, and then when the mind is so quick, you know, is there any hope? And I said, well, yes, obviously there is hope. Otherwise, the Buddha wouldn't have taught us. But it's really learning how to understand how the mind moves like that. What it fastens onto, what it's drawn to, or what it's repelled by, because that in itself is a becoming as well. And we take birth in our, on a moment-to-moment basis in according to our likes and our dislikes. So that same process is what generates the birth at the death of the body. And well, you don't really have to worry about it that much, in the sense that the nature of the training is to develop a familiarity and understanding, a penetration. And even in on a very mundane level, as we, even when one is drawn to practice and virtue, the overwhelming tendency of the mind is toward goodness. And then even at the death process, the senses start to break down, and the mind is more internalized and isn't drawn to the senses, so that just a little bit of sensory input around we're not paying attention to that. It's the attention is being drawn to the heart itself. But that's why we practice, that's why we train, so that impetus and momentum of attention is really focused on that which is clear, is steady, is peaceful, is turning to relinquishment and letting go. And letting go of the things which create a sense of dissonance and discontent within the mind. And that's what when the Buddha talks about right view from a supramundane or a transcendent perspective, then that right view is couched in a more of a psychological mode, more of a moment-to-moment basis, and focusing on the Four Noble Truths, recognizing the nature of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, its cause, its cessation, and the path leading to cessation. So that these two work together, and I think it's important to be reflecting on both these perspectives, and to be recognizing that they work together and inform each other. Because if we hone in too closely on just the kind of on a psychological mode, we can certainly, it's essential to penetrate that. But I think it's also essential to have that kind of the mundane mode of recognizing these cycles of birth and death in order to have a sense of urgency, a sense of motivation in practice. There are questions that we still don't know the answers for. There are do we feel confident and comfortable at the thought of our own death? And that's a that's about as primal as it gets in terms of what are the things that are most conducive to insecurity and fear, anxiety, and everything else pales. I didn't get my coffee at the right temperature. The right thing doesn't really sort of, you can work up a lot of concern about that, but it pales when you think about, oh God, I'm going to die. Jeez. And we put it off. We could distract ourselves with all sorts of concerns and worries and desires and fascinations and responsibilities and duties, and that goes, whether you're in the world or in a monastery. I mean, we're extraordinarily adept at distracting ourselves. You can do that on retreat. Or have sort of ideal conditions and find some project to do. Get stuck on some desert island by yourself, nothing else to do. And rationalize that somehow it's a necessary thing to, count how many grains of sand there are on the beach. I remember one monk who was in retreat, silent retreat, complete solitude, in a cave. Food was brought to him. Didn't go on alms round just for a year. And and got absolutely obsessed with trying to remember what the 50 states of America were. And I had to light a candle, and it was completely dark. I had to light a candle to do it, and had to, because he kept losing track, so he had to write it all down. And he's not even American. But, you know, the mind can get obsessed, that we can distract ourselves. So that to be able to draw our attention back to what's really important, what's necessary. And you know, that the statement of his holiness, "I'm preparing to die," is really, I thought, was really brilliant. Very, very simple, but really hones in. That in our practice, really coming back to what are the essentials, what's necessary, what do we have to do, and you know what we certainly need to do, and what all the practice is grounded in is with mindfulness. I mean, it's all the basic principles, but it's really, I think, really getting that sense of urgency. And also there's a quality that the Buddha talks about, appamada, which is translated as heedfulness, circumspection, care, and he said that of all the qualities that one needs to cultivate the path from the beginning to the end, the one that stands out foremost is this quality of appamada, of heedfulness, circumspection, care. He said the heedfulness is the path to the deathless. And whereas, say, those who are heedful are this quality of clarity and care, don't need to die. So the heedless are as if dead already. And say, this quality of really taking care, mindfulness, circumspection, being very careful in the things that one does. And careful not in the sense of being anxious, because that's suffering right there. But it's something where one's really alive to the practice. One's really alive to the situation. One's really present with what one's doing. And then, of course, one of the things we have to do is recognize, well, what are the things that do distract us? What pulls us out? And then the Buddha points to the qualities when he speaks of what are the causes of suffering, of dissatisfaction, unsatisfactoriness. There's say three different types of desire. Desire for kama tanha, desire for sensual gratification, bhava tanha, desire for being or becoming, that sense of establishing a sense of self or me or place or situation, and the desire for not becoming, kind of rejection, pushing away, aversion to situations, people, even towards oneself. So that sense of rejection, holding back, pushing away, and that so that those looking at that internally, of what the mind seeking gratification, seeking pleasure, seeking comfort, seeking that sense of excitement that comes with that kind of hit of sensory contact that's stimulating. And there's that constant effort to replicate or refine or absorb into that kind of pleasure. I mean, that gets very tiring. It isn't as if it's not pleasurable, but it's just it's a lot of effort. It's a lot of work, and that sense of the being, becoming, the sense of, that's where a lot of the sense of self is established, a sense of me, being something, being somebody, trying to fulfill either an image that we have for ourselves or trying to project that into situations, or the, you know, the attraction to becoming a certain person, certain, or attaining certain states. Because even we can be you know, kind of spiritual becoming, that sense of, you know, trying to become, you know, kind of the peaceful meditator, the perfect meditator. And that's doomed to failure. This is, because you can't ever kind of achieve that. Because it's the nature of desire is that it can't really be fulfilled, and you're always going to be desiring another state that's more refined and more pleasant, more peaceful. So even our, one has to watch that, especially when we're in retreat, because it's so justifiable and it's true. You know, in the sense that we need to be cultivating the practice to develop states of peace, states of clarity, states of stillness. But it's that identification with it, and the identification with the desire itself. That's the problem. And that desire for non-becoming, not wanting to have to deal with this, not wanting to have to be in this situation, be with this person, be with this responsibility or chore. And you see that coming up, you know, whether it's in, you know, in practice, in meditation, I mean, sometimes it's, you know, one just gets so bored with even having to be with oneself. It's the but we do that with the ordinary chores, ordinary things that we're doing. And there's a lot of vibhava tanha, that desire for non-becoming, because we're just that, you know, getting tired of doing something, getting bored with something, waiting for it to end, waiting for a particular chore to end. And it's like that's what we spend most of our life, just waiting for things to end. You know, when's this going to be over? When is the morning chore time going to be over so we can have the meal? When is this particular task going to be over? And even when one's doing it, you know, we're not really present with what one's doing, because one's sort of all, you know, kind of fed up with what one's doing is looking to something else. It's generated by that desire for non-becoming. So to investigate those pulls in the mind, you know, because it's a pushing and pulling that takes us away from just a central core of stillness and clarity that is possible. And, I mean, that's the whole purpose of the practice, and the whole sort of the kind of the promise of the Buddha is that it's possible to free the mind. It's possible to liberate oneself. It's possible to be peaceful, happy. It's a happiness that's not dependent on gratification or getting things the way one wants. Just a happiness that is there within the heart. This is, as the Buddha says, that then, you know, if it wasn't possible to be liberated and to be free, then I wouldn't, and if you weren't capable of doing it, I wouldn't teach it. But it's because you are capable of doing it, and because there is this possibility, that I teach it. And that's an encouragement that the Buddha gives. So that that attending with mindfulness to the ability of the mind, one, to be aware, and for that awareness to be able to be sustained, so that in our formal meditation, really attending to the meditation object, attending to the breath, so that refining and clarifying, how do we attend to the meditation object? Because we can, you know, we can be trying too hard, and then we squeeze it, we crush it, we crush that clarity and spaciousness and stillness. And then we try so hard, and that's a becoming, isn't it? That's the bhava tanha. Or we disturb the mind by wanting it to be pleasurable. Because it's, say, the, you know, that gamatanda, the desire for pleasure, you know, wanting it to be completely pleasant, and then being averse to whatever discomfort that is experienced, whether it's physical or mental. And, you know, the meditation is really allowing oneself to dwell in awareness rather than trying to get anything out of it, to make the mind be a certain way, make the experience be how we conceive it or want it or desire it or afraid that it's going to be. Just nurturing that awareness, sustaining the mindfulness. So that, and in, that's the meditation object is just a vehicle for supporting that. And the breath is the most common object that we teach, but there's many, many different ways that we can do it. And certainly the same for walking meditation. You're taking just the simple act of walking, paying attention to the movement, paying attention just to simple act of lifting, moving, setting down the right foot, lifting, moving, setting down the left foot, being attentive to the posture, the body, the sensations in the body, but nurturing that awareness and allowing that awareness to be sort of standing up. Becoming clear. And then, of course, carrying that into whatever else we're doing as much as we can. And this period of time for the community is the summer retreat time. So this, you know, we all have our opportunities for solitary retreat, but the rest of us also, you know, are doing, practicing it at within the community as well. So that learning how to bring this practice into as much as what we can do, and the more that we can bring it into everything we do, the more momentum there is in the formal meditation. So that exploring these, that cultivation of and sustaining of awareness. One has to recognize, well, what is it that pulls the mind out into that becoming and birth? And what allows the mind to turn more to the non-becoming? Non-attachment, non-becoming. Not being born into anything. And as we explore that, and we're willing to explore that, you know, the mind can become very, very still, very, very silent. And allow that to to open up, kind of, because it's like a wedge in there, because the mind is so habituated to movement, and just allow that silence or that stillness to just create a wedge in the habit of movement. And then rather than allowing the attention to be hijacked by the movement, just start recognizing that stillness, that silence, and allow the mind to rest in that. Allow the mind to start, just be very comfortable, the heart being at ease. Because what do we need to get? What do we need to become? And you ask that question, and we're able to put things down. So that putting down of just a habit. And you realize it's just a habit. It has no kind of intrinsic stable base. I mean, you see the nature of the mind changing all the time. And we've convinced ourselves that there's some necessity to be thinking and desiring and gratifying and fearing and worrying. But as you are willing to question that, you realize, no, there's no, that doesn't have a sort of an enduring core to that at all. We don't have to kind of believe in it. We don't have to identify with it. We can let that go. And then the more we're willing to let that go, the more that these wedges of stillness and wedges of silence start to open up. And to attend to that, and delight in it. That's where our real ease and happiness comes from. And it's not a happiness that's, because you can be experiencing that even with discomfort, pain, physically. Or the mind can be sort of resisting, but then if you start questioning it, allowing to open, you realize that stillness and that silence, that spaciousness, is actually there all the time. So question the practice. Explore it. Explore the ability of the mind to settle, to relinquish. And even the quality of knowing. And you start questioning, even questioning that. And say, famous teacher in Thailand, one of the disciples of Ajahn Mun. Oh, actually, we have a relic of his here, Lumpu Ted. And he was asked, you know, what do we do with the, you know, when the knowing and awareness becomes really steady and still? And he said, start looking at what's behind that. And don't, because it's, you know, we can build up a whole philosophical series of the, because it's in Thai particular, most the Thai teachers and would use that, say the pulu, the knowing, as a, you know, an epithet for kind of the purity of the mind, that pure awareness. And it's don't rest in an idea of you've made it to the sort of the puru, and that, you know, look behind that. And because that, what that does is allow you to turn to, you know, to relinquishing, to letting go. Ajahn Tan he had a doubt in his practice at one point. And it was around the nature of sankhara, mental formations, that with the sort of the letting go of the body, letting go of feelings, he could see that he had major penetrations around that and realizations around that. But then he started wondering about these mental formations. We have to rely on them to investigate and to penetrate even further. Are we supposed to even let go of that? What do I do? And he kind of pretty much worked through it in his practice, and he had confidence and clarity. But then he had the opportunity when Ajahn Chah died. And Ajahn Mahabua, who was a senior living disciple of Ajahn Man, came down to visit and pay respects and give encouragement to the community at Ajahn Chah's monastery. And Ajahn Dan was one of the monks who was assigned to be his attendant. And there was actually a few of us there. I was there myself. And Ajahn Dan asked Ajahn Mahabua this kind of doubt. What are we, you know, in terms of practice, what are we, you know, with mental formations and sankharas, and how should we regard that? How should we work with it? How should we? Because they're, you know, once you've trained, then they can be really wholesome, skillful, beneficial. Ajahn Mahabua's sort of immediate remark is, don't keep anything back at all. Don't try to save anything at all. Just really let go of everything. And that, It was a wonderful teaching, and coming from such a pure space. And it isn't as if, you know, letting go of everything, you know, turns you into a zombie or a dysfunctional human being. That's actually how you become an extraordinarily functional human being, and how you are able to function with no suffering. And again, this is the encouragement of the Buddha. This is the promise of the Buddha. Take this path and practice it. Take this path and train. Take these teachings and live by them. And it is a gradual training. It is a gradual path. And to pay attention to the different areas of training. But, you know, we have this opportunity to do it. You know, don't hold back. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.